Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, our romp through Romans continues. The glory of God's children revealed, groans too deep for words. No separation anxiety. Israel's glory and God's choice. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
A new term, it's not that new, but it's really being used a lot, especially by families with kids going off to college, or in this case, not going off to college. Maybe they finished their freshman year with COVID-19 looming over them, and mom and dad said, you know, maybe you should take one of those, and here's the term, maybe you should take one of those gap years. Just take a year off. Let's see what happens at your university. Let's see how they're going to do classes. Let's see how they're going to get back on their feet if they are financially in trouble. So with more kids staying home, is it going to change higher education? With the online standard and tools being built for online education, will it change whether or not you even go off to college? Maybe it's just off to the basement to get your college education. And how many of the changes that seem temporary in the face of a global pandemic will turn out to be permanent? We're going to talk about higher education post-COVID-19. Joining us to do so on this Wednesday afternoon, Eric Hiller. He's managing partner of Hiller Associates, a consulting firm specializing in product cost management. He holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and a master's and bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Illinois. He's author of a column for MarketWatch on coronavirus and higher education. Eric, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Pastor Wilkin. I'm glad to be here.
Talk about the state of higher education before the global pandemic.
Well, the state of higher education is, in some sense, it was good in the sense that it had grown to be huge and a bigger and bigger, more pervasive part of people's lives, where 50 years ago, not everyone got a college degree, but it had grown to be something that's almost expected and ubiquitous. So in that sense of the word of good, it was good in the sense that a lot more people were doing it. However, there have been kind of naysayers or prognosticators for years that have been decrying that, you know, the emperor has no clothes or that there's structural problems. For example, Clay Christensen, who is very famous from Harvard Business School, the professor who wrote books like The Innovator's Dilemma and Innovative Solution about disruptive technologies and disruptive models, talks about, with one of his co-authors, a host of struggling colleges and universities, the bottom 20% of every tier we predict will disappear or merge in the next 10 to 15 years. Now, that was in like 2014 or something like that, but it actually turns out when you look at it, things are closing, and it's worse for for-profits, strangely, than nonprofits. But it's not quite as dire as what Christensen and Horn said. But I do think there was a kind of a looming sense of foreboding that people were becoming aware en masse that the college social contract was broken. It was more like COVID kind of punctured the balloon or as an accelerant.
Why were so many schools in a precarious state already before COVID?
Well, in a basic economic sense, it's supply and demand. The system had been growing and growing and growing, not only in the traditional nonprofit schools, religious schools, state-funded schools, but all of these for-profit people getting into the industry. And I used to work in the auto industry, and one of the really bad things in the auto industry is overcapacity, where it's hard to sell a profit with good margin when there's just too many providers out there and kind of making the product less scarce. On top of that, what that forces, and I know from my experience with higher education, both as a student and also on the side of management in it, discount rates were far too high, especially in private schools where they have these very high tuitions. But especially if you're not an elite school, you have to discount so deeply that you're not making the profit you want. on the other hand, from a student point of view, the percentage of revenue from tuition has been going up and up and up. In fact, this original article was written from a segment I saw in Tucker Carlson, but I also saw a segment just recently after I wrote the article from Anderson Cooper with a professor from New York Stern School of Business. And he talked about how the tuition rates had gone up 1,400% in the last 40 years, which if you do the math, and I went and checked out inflation, that's six times as fast as the general cost of living. And he brings out the point that the only thing that gets 90 points of gross margin, like education does in many cases, so especially at the elite schools, is something like a life-saving cancer drug or something like this. So the students perceive and the parents perceive that the tuition is just going through the roof, and people have anecdotally talked about that for as long as since I was in college, sadly a long time ago. Also, the demographics of students are changing, and they aren't always favorable in the sense of monetary resources to go to college. Then you bounce that against the tuition, and then you have state and national funding continues to go down. For example, when I was at school starting, I think they funded the University of Illinois, the state of Illinois did it, 70% of the operating budget, if I remember right. Hopefully I'm getting that right. And by the time I left, and that was many years ago, it was down to 20%. So that's massive structural changes in the environment in which higher education is operating.
For decades, a college degree has been considered essential to pursuing the American dream. How are attitudes and thinking about higher education changing?
Well, I'm afraid, as Luther to Erasmus in Bondage of the Will, you've gone for the jugular here. What's happening here is that there was a certain sense that the college degree was the ability to write your ticket, and that had occurred for hundreds of years. And certainly up until maybe the 80s, that was the pervasive feeling that I go to college, I get this credential, and this credential opens doors for me and assures me a certain minimum level of lifestyle. That is no longer true, where you see, and that's for a variety of reasons. We may not have time to get into all of them today, but there's a feeling now that I go to college and this credential is not scarce anymore. It doesn't have the value. And that's even with an elite school like a Harvard Business School. Even there, the value of that degree is diluted by the fact there are so many other colleges offering that degree, and the ruthless pace of globalism and cost-cutting in companies. Companies are more willing to take someone, maybe they aren't quite as quote-unquote on average good as someone from one of these elite schools in their training. Maybe they are, who knows? But they're willing to accept them and take that chance and pay them less, whatever that is, 60% on the dollar or whatever it is. So the feeling is, I go to school, and now I think the average student carries about $29,000 of debt when they leave college, which personally seems low to me from the people I would know. I think a lot of people end up with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, and they're leaving school with a debt burden that they never can pay off, especially depending on their degree. If you're getting a sociology degree or something like that, you may not have as favorable job prospects as other things. And so people are really questioning the value and starting to look to things like, am I better off to go to, I don't know, a camp for programmers, because they don't care what my credential is as long as I can get certified with certain technical certifications, or maybe the trades, you know, a plumber, electrician, these sorts of things. These folks make good money and they have certain protections that in our at-will economy, you know, you could be fired for all sorts of silly reasons, and you have no protection, where in certain trades, you have a union behind you or other protections.
So how has COVID-19 and the global pandemic affected higher education in the short term?
Well, in the short term, obviously, it's if you would have had the forethought and knowledge, or maybe been a prophet or the son of a prophet, to know this was going to occur, you could have invested in FedEx and UPS, and you could have also invested in online educational technology companies and startups and technology platforms like Zoom or GoToMeeting, WebEx, Microsoft Teams, whatever the platform might be to deliver these sorts of educational models. So in the short term, these sorts of people have been benefited, and also it has probably caused a lot of angst and consternation, not only on the student side, but on the faculty side, as schools prepare to take cuts, not only in their management, but maybe lay off professors and faculty. But I think the biggest thing is a psychological change, where even though really good technology has existed, or good enough technology perhaps, for 10, 15, 20 years to do certain levels of online education, there's, I think, a stigma in many people's minds that online education is kind of like an online correspondence course, the way people used to view that before the days of the internet, or an online junior college. Well, now there's been kind of the great leveling, if you will, that everybody has to use the online technology. So therefore, it removes the stigma and it forces you to try something or accept something that maybe you were kind of afraid to do. The people on the administrative and the educational pedagogical side weren't real for it or were afraid of it, and maybe the students or the parents were, and now everybody has to. So the question is, if that affects it in the short term, when things go back to normal, does that persist where people are really going to start questioning the value and whether they can get it in a more effective and efficient way through an online model? Or do things kind of just slowly within a year or two go back to normal where, hey, the football games, the pep rallies, the esprit de corps of being on a brick and mortar campus still has value so much beyond just the theoretical online education?
Eric Hiller is our guest. We're talking about higher education post-COVID-19. On the other side, I wonder if these short-term changes will lead fewer people to pursue a college degree. I've written a column for the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Closed Communion, Biblical, Historical, Lutheran, and Loving. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Nancy Almodovar writes about her journey from the profound doubt produced by her former Calvinist beliefs to the absolute certainty of Lutheran theology. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
At Zion Lutheran Church, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, we've adopted the motto, A Changeless Christ for a Changing World. While many congregations try to market a message that appeals to what a changing world wants, we continue to give a constantly changing world what it needs. A changeless Christ in word and sacraments like the church has done for 2,000 years. If you're in Chippewa Falls and would like to have the forgiveness of sins, eternal life, and salvation that Jesus won on the cross and delivers today in his church, please join us poor, miserable sinners. For more information, visit cfzionlutheran.com.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community with car and personal loans, mortgages, credit cards, checking and savings accounts. Lutheran FCU supports LCMS organizations with its Spotlight Ministry program, and Lutheran Federal Credit Union allows you to make purchases with Apple Pay, Google Pay, and Samsung Pay using your digital wallet. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Good for you, good for the church, Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. LutherAcademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/LutherAcademy.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about higher education post-COVID with Eric Hiller. He's author of a column for MarketWatch on coronavirus and higher education. So, Eric, do you think that these short-term changes that we were discussing before the break will lead to even fewer people pursuing a college degree?
Well, I think they will in the short term, because people are talking about, you know, these gap years. So people are really shooken up about the uncertainty and the kind of the malaise, depression that COVID and other problems in society bring, but that also opens people's minds to trying new things. So people are thinking, well, maybe I'll do one of these gap years where if I have the resources, maybe I'll travel a little or I'll get a job and just kind of live after high school. Maybe I'll go in the military for a couple years, that sort of thing. I think that is something that may affect people in the short term. Whether that lasts in the long term, I don't know. I would say it will result in less people going to college in the traditional way. I think there will be some residual of people that are going to say, you know what, this didn't seem that different from being on campus. And the big thing, which we can get into, is does a student have discipline to do that? So I think it's not going to work for everyone, but given the thin margins a lot of colleges are operating on and the final margin, even the gross margin's high, if it peels off 5-10% of students to online models, that's going to be a huge hit to the kind of momentum that's going on in education of trying to get bigger and bigger.
So let's talk a little bit about the long-term effects of COVID-19 on higher education.
Well, I think that's probably difficult, but if I were going to prognosticate on it, I would say, will it force online education to deliver the efficiency it should? And what I mean by that is, although I didn't talk about it in the article, when I was doing some research maybe for another article to write on it, I was shocked to find that actually the average credit hour from online education is more expensive than the average credit hour in brick and mortar, which seems shocking. It's actually, according to the investment advisors, BMO, the average credit hour of an in-state online bachelor's program was $277 versus $243 at a brick and mortar school, and that was in 2013. BMO did that, and it was published in Forbes. So the question is, and I think we'd all ask why. Now, granted, a lot of this stuff is from masters, and my article is about undergrad, but this was more, strangely, a lot of people are doing online stuff with masters and PhD or graduate work. But in undergrad, the question is, can that cost be gotten down? Because I think all of us would be scratching our heads saying, I don't get it. I mean, in a lot of things like calculus is calculus, it doesn't change, you know, for an undergrad type of thing. Does that mean that we, over time, get these classes to be where it's brick and mortar is $243 per brick per hour, but online class costs $100 or something like that? And why can't it be? I think if they can solve that problem, then I think you have real long-term change, because you end up with more of a great courses model where the best professors will be tapped to teach and the best textbooks will be used by students, because it'll feel like kind of an Amazon online buying experience where everything will be rated 1 to 5 stars. And that's a lot harder to do within a college. You have less choice. But when you have a national, even international, platform of people that are making money off of royalties for lectures they've made and books they've written rather than a fixed salary, I think it could have an effect. And it's definitely not going to affect all schools, but I think on the lower end of the margin, where you're talking third, fourth tier schools, especially small colleges, I think it could have a big effect.
Do you think that online education is a universal solution for post-COVID higher education?
No, definitely not. I mean, there are some things, and maybe I'm wrong, that I just don't think work really well with online education. For example, well, so first of all, I'm kind of a positive case for that. Simply networking, right? Like if part of the value of your networking is be it one of these Ivy League schools or very high-end state schools where you're making relationships to last the rest of your life, those relationships are far deeper when you've broken bread with people for a long time, been at parties, that sort of stuff, than when you're online, right? Also, classes that require one-on-one interaction, like the performance arts, if you're doing music, dance, theater, I would think that'd be extremely hard to do when you're not physically in interaction most of the time. Or conversely, not the fine arts, but if you have a class that requires debate and interaction, it could be done online, but I think it's less easy if you're talking like case studies in law schools and business schools, and you're going to rely on that model. it's just harder to have that kind of debate when you're not in the same room. Obviously, wet labs, if you're talking the sciences, engineering, you could do most of that online, but the wet lab itself, you may have to go somewhere. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't share wet labs among many schools and have very high utilization of the facilities, which right now might be idle sometimes. And then finally, things that require project teams, that can be done online. It's just a little harder when you're doing senior design projects for an engineering or you're doing other type team-based work. But I think those are more challenging, let's say, for online education. There is one thing you haven't asked, though, that I think is probably even tougher to deal with, and that is the problem of discipline. That people bemoan that the students today just don't have the discipline that people did years ago. Whether that's true or not doesn't really matter, but what does matter is it is much harder for most students to have the discipline to learn when they are not physically in a classroom with a teacher pushing them and in that kind of ecosystem and environment of learning. When they're just at home, maybe even at mom and dad's house, it doesn't feel any different than when they were at high school. But guess what? At high school, the teachers were taking a lot more personal time with them and really very invested in their success, where in college, hey, it's up to you. So I think that's the biggest thing that's really going to matter on the student side is, do you have a student that has the discipline to make that kind of model work?
Eric Hiller is our guest. We're talking about higher education post-COVID-19. On the other side of the break, how do lectures work in the medium of online education? After our conversation with Eric concludes, Abigail Schreier of the Wall Street Journal will join us to talk about the doubled standard of stay-at-home orders. One order for churches and another for basically everyone else. Then we're going to talk about the Council of Nicaea with Dr. Joel Olowski of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. When we come back, lectures. You give one lecture and just play it over and over again? Do you give a different lecture each time? Or what do you do? You turn it into a game? We'll talk about that next.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
My parents read these books to me. I read them to my children, and I plan to read the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Archbook's Treasury, Life of Jesus, to my grandchildren. This contains 12 archbooks. They're bound in a commemorative hardcover format, and they detail Jesus' life from His birth to His resurrection. Find out more about Archbook's Treasury, Life of Jesus, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June at our website, issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House and order this book for your children, grandchildren, godchildren, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. We're talking about higher education post-COVID-19. Eric Hiller is our guest. He's managing partner of Hiller Associates, a consulting firm specializing in product cost management. He holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and a master's and bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Illinois. He's author of a column for MarketWatch on coronavirus and higher education. So, Eric, how do lectures work in the medium of online education?
Well, it depends. You know, I think early on, people had just kind of videotaped lectures and said, well, it's the same lecture. Why can't I just give it? Because of this discipline problem and attention span, and maybe that also has to do societally with people having less attention spans, people started to say, we probably need to do this in a different way. So I think lectures, there's a lot of models that still use canned lectures, if you will, and sometimes they're recorded and you watch them anytime. Other times they are live with a professor at a whiteboard, but if they're canned, they can be split up into smaller segments. And there's a whole move within education and pedagogy online because of the attention span problem to do gamification, I think they call it, which is basically maybe I watch a lecture on something, but instead of an hour-long lecture like I traditionally would have, I watch 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and then that lecture is combined with problem sets or quizzes or something like that, where it forces me to keep my attention span. It engages me more. I feel like I'm more part of it. And if I can make it feel like a game more, like I want to win at this and it's kind of fun, then I'm more likely to go through it. But there's obviously several different models of these lectures. And that gets into the why online education can be very expensive, because gamifying a lecture or a course in general is far more expensive than just taping a professor doing a lecture at a whiteboard.
Let's talk a little bit about the use of textbooks in online education. What would be the effect there?
Well, it depends if schools and professors retain control in the same way they do today. So if you probably remember your college education or mine, you go into a course, you have a choice of textbooks. I mean, I guess you could go buy anything you want, but you'd probably have a textbook assigned from the professor. And oh, by the way, one way professors supplement their income, and it can be very lucrative, especially if they get a situation where everyone in a freshman required class has to use a certain textbook, is they write textbooks and then they get royalties from them. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying that's bad at all for professors to do. Good for them. It's good incentive to add more thought and care into the class. The problem is you're kind of restricted to what the professor wants you to use. And that also, certainly it's not decided always by the individual professor. Sometimes it's departmental committees and things like that are deciding together. Well, that could work the same exact way online. However, there's probably, once again, going to be this real irresistible urge to basically say, why can't we use the best textbook? I don't care if my professor wrote it. We could use any textbook, and I think psychologically it's harder to push against that over time on an online model. Because, as we all know, there are textbooks that are really good, and there are textbooks that are really bad. Or as one person once said to me, there are two types of textbooks. Textbooks professors write to try to educate students, and textbooks they write to impress their colleagues. And a lot of times the latter gets into classrooms and they just aren't useful, where online I think the push is going to be, we just want to use the textbook that makes the course as easy to use, especially because perhaps online you need to rely more on how the textbook is teaching you, because maybe you have less interaction one-on-one with a person.
You had mentioned problem sets and quizzes. What advantages does online education present for testing and problem sets?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword, probably. The advantage is, once again, you can break up these quizzes and tests into much smaller segments, right? You can almost do it real-time, if you will, as the student's learning. You can start to reinforce these things. You also could share tests or pools of problem sets across colleges or across the nation probably easier. However, I think testing is difficult in the online world, because there's already a real problem in academia with students cheating for a variety of reasons, and professors are always trying to keep their tests secret, because writing a good test is a major endeavor. It takes a lot of time to do. And so you try not to write tests where you have a test and then you have to rewrite it every time, because that just takes a lot of effort. It tends to force you also, when you're online, you're probably going to lean toward answers that can be made into a survey, right? Like multiple choice, true and false, select all that apply, these sorts of things. And that's okay. And a lot of standardized tests obviously are given that way. But it could be a lot harder for the professor to give partial credit or understand how well the student is learning when you can't see their work, right? Now, it's a lot easier, right? Because you push a button, the test gets scored, it pops out, it's instantaneous. The student knows literally in seconds what grade they got versus the rest of the class, and you can see the whole bell curve of the class, right? That's positive. But I think tests are going to be a challenge, because it's a lot easier to cheat or record questions, screenshot things, all this stuff when you're online. So I would envision maybe there's a lot more pooling or sharing of test questions among universities across the world, even, because it's kind of like a shoe in Las Vegas, right? When you have one deck or two decks, maybe you can count cards, but when you have 10 decks or 20 decks in a shoe, really hard to count the cards. So same way with testing, if you have a kind of a more infinite pool of questions you could throw, that makes it a lot harder for this cheating to occur.
How do online office hours and interaction with students work?
Well, they can work in a variety of ways, but here I think there is an advantage of on the online model. I really do think so. Now, the disadvantage is, once again, you can't be physically present with your professor in his or her office, you know, looking at the whiteboard, working through it. And that is a disadvantage, notwithstanding the fact there certainly are good online whiteboard applications where theoretically you can be talking to someone and seeing a little talking head in the corner and then watching something go. You each have a pen that you're working with on the whiteboard, but it's just not the same experience. That's the downside. The upside is this. Theoretically, it could be 24/7 capable, meaning your own professor, TA, might have certain, quote, digital office hours or online office hours you can go to. Quite frankly, when I was in school, I remember professors bemoaning that they held 2 to 4 hours of office hours a week, and they probably had less than 1 hour of students talking to them because the students didn't have the agency to go talk to them, or maybe I was just dumber, so I went. I don't know. But in any case, online, it doesn't have to necessarily be the professor, right? You could outsource this, like a lot of other things, to lower cost countries and have 24/7 support, where if it's for a problem set you're doing as homework or going over a test question or just getting help on a concept, you could have this kind of support where the student any time of day or night can put themselves in a queue, and within 5 minutes someone pops up on the screen and say, how can I help you? And these organizations are paid to cover certain courses for certain universities, so they're supposed to be familiar with the content and the syllabus, and they're supposed to be able to help you. Theoretically, that would be very convenient for most students, and they could do it any time and for as long as they want. They would feel a lot less self-conscious, too, possibly, of talking to someone that's more, quote, anonymous and going over the same problem 4 times if they didn't get it than they would with a professor. So that would be a really positive aspect of, like, office hours and support to do that versus what happens today.
Finally, Eric, it's being kind of widely predicted and even observed occurring now that COVID is going to, at the very least, kind of decimate small private colleges, and in particular, colleges and universities that do not have enormous endowments. What are your final thoughts there?
Well, I mean, it's an issue of both profit and cash flow, meaning how much money do you have in the endowment to get you through? As one of the articles I said, there was a tongue-in-cheek article making fun of presidents at elite universities with big endowments. The first rule of the endowment is we don't talk about the endowment, kind of in the Fight Club sense of the first rule. Fight Club is we don't talk about Fight Club. So the question is, do you have the balance sheet or the cash in the bank to stake you through what could be 2 to 3 really off years? And that's making the assumption that things return to the new normal. The question is, if it doesn't go exactly back to normal, so you have the short-term cash flow problem, can I get through? That could be covered by the government if the government believes higher education is still the social contract that everyone's being told. The government, or if it's a religious school, are there private funding sources there through denominations or whatever that can stake these colleges through the short term? But the question is, long term, do the financials work for these smaller colleges if it does peel off 5 to 10%? Because the thing about online education is it's like a tool, right? The reason why you invest in a specific tool, like maybe to stamp a piece of sheet metal, is because you're going to make a lot of them, and the tool's expensive and it takes a long time to create. Once I have it though, bang, 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 I can just shoot out these parts, right? Otherwise, I would just custom do it, if you will. And online education is more like that tool. So in order to create that tool and get your money out of it, you have to have 2 things. You have to have the money to invest in creating the tool, but you also have to have the volume to put through that tool. That's going to encourage economies of scale and consolidation, where imagine you have Amazon Education. or Google Classes or something like that, where someone with really deep pockets gets involved that does have the balance sheet and the cash reserves to invest in really slick online courses. And because they are a trusted brand that people are willing to take a chance on because they're perceived as a new economy, whatnot, students go there. If that peels off 5 or 10% of students from most small colleges, they get shut down or they have to merge. I don't think the financials can withstand it. I know in my own work with higher education, we were always working on something where every year we were just living kind of paycheck to paycheck, if you will, year to year. And if we dropped 30 or 40 students, that could be theoretically disastrous.
Eric Hiller is managing partner of Hiller Associates, a consulting firm specializing in product cost management. He holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and a master's and bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Illinois. He's author of a column for MarketWatch on coronavirus and higher education. You can read it on the Talk On Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you, Pastor. Appreciate it.
On the topic of finance, Lutheran Federal Credit Union serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community with car and home loans, credit and debit cards, checking and savings accounts. Find out more at LutheranFCU.org. Good for you, good for the church. Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org. Abigail Schreier of the Wall Street Journal will join us on the other side of the break. We'll be talking about the double standard of stay-at-home orders. Churches are getting the short end of the stick still in some states. Then Dr. Joel Olowski will join us to discuss the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD.
Did you know that for over 40 years, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries with low-cost loans and resources? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Because of faithful investors like you, we've been able to help church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations. To learn how you can get involved, call 800-843-8233.
The COVID-19 pandemic has caused many Christians to ask about whether or not the government should be telling the church when and how to gather around our Lord's gifts. In the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Christopher Thoma takes up this question in his article titled, Executive Orders, Divine Command. To read this excellent article and more about the church's life in the midst of a pandemic, subscribe to the Lutheran Witness today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Major A.J. Vogel, United States Army.
And this is Pastor Josh Leigaber of Trinity Lutheran Church, a confessional liturgical congregation located at Leesville and Fort Polk, Louisiana.
If you ever find yourself at Fort Polk, we invite you to join us to receive the gifts of Christ in word and sacrament.
For more information, visit us on Facebook or at trinityleesville.com.
Timeless truth that prepares scholars to serve their neighbor in all of life through their various vocations. This is what scholars receive at Wittenberg Academy. If you are looking for a solidly Lutheran online education for your child, consider Wittenberg Academy, where doctrine is sound, academics are rigorous, and relationships are genuine. We offer full-time, part-time, and diploma track options to meet your child's Lutheran education needs. We partner with brick-and-mortar schools and homeschools. You can find out more at wittenbergacademy.org.